What do the oldest cultures in the world have to teach us about raising happy, well-adjusted children?
There's such little resistance. Like, there's such little conflict. The moms are calm, yet very confident and clearly in charge. But there's no yelling or bickering or negotiating with the kids. And the kids, at the same time, were really great. They, you know, they were respectful and generous with each other and with their friends, and super, super helpful.
That's Michaeline Duclef. We talk with her about her book, Hunt, Gather, Parent. Then a leading social psychologist reveals the family secrets that drove her to study how technology is eroding human connections.
I sort of became the Nancy Drew of my own life story, trying to pick up clues about my identity. Who was my father? Why was he being hidden? And most of all, to become empathic with my mother, my grandmother, my grandfather, my aunt, my mother's sister, who were raising me in a tissue of lies.
That's Sherry Turkle. She tells us about her fascinating memoir, The Empathy Diaries. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. I have to confess, when I first heard about Michaeline Duclef's book, Hunt, Gather, Parent, I thought to myself, just another parenting book. When my son was growing up, I consulted a lot of them, but only one or two told me anything useful. So I was intrigued but skeptical when I sat down to read about what Duclef had to say about what ancient cultures can teach us about the lost art of raising happy, helpful little humans, the subtitle of her book. I was quickly won over by Duclef's combination of her personal story, trying to parent her strong-willed young daughter, her research into parenting styles of three indigenous cultures, including Maya families in Mexico, Inuit families above the Arctic Circle, and Hadzabe families in Tanzania, and her eminently practical suggestions. But her ideas don't just work for young children. They work for relationships we have with family members of all ages. Michaeline Duclef is a correspondent for NPR's Science Desk, where she reports on disease outbreaks, cross-cultural parenting, and women and children's health. Hunt, Gather, Parent is a New York Times bestseller. Michaeline Duclef, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I could relate so much to this book, Hunt, Gather, Parent. You start this book out with the daily power struggles with your then toddler, Rosie, so very, very young child. And you were afraid that you and her were becoming enemies. Tell us what was happening.
You know, Rosie has just, from the time she was born, she was very fiery, you know, like as a baby, there was a lot of crying and I had really no clue how to stop her sometimes. But then as she became a toddler, it became much more physical. You know, she would start to have a tantrum and I really wanted to help her, but everything I kind of did seemed to make things worse. And we would kind of get into this cycle of like, I would make her more angry. And then eventually I would get angry at her. And of course, me getting upset and angry at a yelling toddler only made things much worse. And so then I would try to pick her up and console her. And then she was in this habit of like slapping me across the face. And it was literally happening, I don't know, several times a week, you know, sometimes like in the supermarket. And I was kind of like, this is only going to get worse, right? Like as she gets older, we are just going to be stuck in this kind of, I need her to do something and she doesn't want to do it. And then there's an emotional outburst and then I get upset and it just seemed like we were really going to be stuck. And to be honest with you, I had kind of given up. I was kind of like, well, this is just how it's going to be. You know, she's a strong-willed child and I didn't think that there was going to be much to do about it.
Right. And you found actually that there is a different way that people raise children and Those are ways that, in fact, people have practiced, you know, for hundreds of thousands of years, most likely, but now are mostly practicing in more indigenous communities. How did you first understand, get an inkling that the way we do it in our Western nations is not the way maybe most humans have been doing it for most of our history?
Yeah. So about the same time as Rosie was a toddler and this was happening, like completely independently, I was sent on an assignment. I'm a correspondent, a global health correspondent at NPR. And I was sent on an assignment down to the Yucatan Peninsula to a small Maya village. And I was actually doing a story about children's attention span. There is some research that showed that in certain situations, Maya children were better at paying attention than, you know, middle-class American kids. And so I was really curious about this, like, what, you know, why is this? And I went down there and I spent a fair amount of time in families' homes talking to moms, mostly moms, because those are the ones that were in the homes. And what I saw had nothing to do with attention, or I was just like blown away by actually the way the moms related to the children. First of all, I spoke into my microphone at the time, just taking notes. And I was just like, there's such little resistance. Like there's such little conflict. The moms are calm yet very confident and clearly in charge, but there's no yelling or bickering or negotiating with the kids. And the kids at the same time were really great. They, you know, they were respectful and generous with each other and with their friends, and super, super helpful. So one morning, a 12-year-old girl, I was talking to a mom, Maria Tumborges. She has three daughters, and the oldest one, they were on spring break, and the oldest one was sleeping in because she had stayed up late to watch a shark movie. And she woke up around 10 or 11, and she walks past me and her mom and just starts doing the dishes, like without anyone asking her. And that was like just the first thing she did in the morning on her spring break. And I was very surprised, and Maria wasn't at all. She was like, you know, she's 12. She knows what needs to be done and should be done. And so she does it now. She's old enough to know. And she also said, you know, it doesn't happen every day. And I left there just really like struck by this, first by this, the very calm, cooperative relationship that I saw between the parents and the children, but also in this way of like, this 12-year-old child who genuinely wanted to help her family. And really, I asked her, I was like, why are you doing the dishes? And she said, I like helping my mom. So it kind of seeded this doubt in my mind of like, oh, like here I am with a kid that I can't even get, you know, to not hit me. And here's this mom with three daughters. And she had a 4-year-old at the time and, you know, was just seemed incredibly skilled at interacting with her children in a way that was very productive. And so I started to wonder, like, maybe what I've been taught as a mom isn't the best way. And I actually went on another reporting trip up to the Arctic to an Inuit town. And by golly, I started to see similar things. I started to see this, a very similar way of interacting with children. And so I started doing research on it and realized that this actually is a very common way of interacting and relating to children that's likely, like you say, tens of thousands of years old, given like how common it is around the world. And even elements of it, you know, you can still find today in parts of Europe, and you can find it in communities here in the U.S. as well.
Yeah. And you mentioned the Inuit. You also took a trip to Baffin Island, which you said is the center of a movement in the Arctic to bring back this kind of traditional parenting. So evidently, this is something people are really aware of as being different. Talk about, you know, what you call weird parenting, and that's an acronym, and this movement, and why do they have to bring it back? In other words, what happened?
Yeah, it's a great question. So WEIRD stands for Western, Educated, Industrialized, Rich, and Democratic. It's an acronym that a Harvard researcher and his collaborators came up with, because what they realized was that, first of all, almost all psychological research, I think like 96% of it, is performed on white middle-class European heritage people. So, you know, Americans and Europeans. And actually, when you look at the other 4%, which is done on the rest of the world, you see that these Westerners are actually atypical. They're exceptional. The way that they respond on psychological experiments is the exception. It's the outlier. And the rest of the world kind of tends to clump more together. And so they coined this term as a way of emphasizing that first of all, that psychological research needs to have a broader view, because we're getting this very tiny slice of humanity that's actually pretty strange. But also to start to realize kind of the some of the things in our culture that we take for granted and I think that are universal aren't at all, that we, the Western ways tend to be the exception. And parenting is one of them. So our parenting, many things, I think one scientist figured out there's about 50 things that we do that you don't really find anywhere else in the world or throughout human history. And they're things that you kind of take for granted, like a lot of praise to a child, toys, like constant entertainment for children and instruction. So up in the Arctic, interestingly, so the Inuit are this incredibly rich culture that spans from about Alaska over to Greenland. They have this massive part of the globe that they're connected through language and culture and tradition. And in the 60s and the 70s, there was this movement from Canada, the U.S., and Denmark. So Alaska, the U.S. and Alaska, Canada and what's called Nunavut now, and then Denmark and Greenland. And there are these movements from these Western countries to settle the Inuit. So at that time, many of the families lived a traditionally nomadic lifestyle where they migrated around often by the shores, hunting with the animals, hunting and foraging to some in the summer. And, you know, they lived that way for hundreds of years, even thousands of years in the Arctic, and have been incredibly successful this way. But in the 60s and the 70s, there was this big movement to settle them. And, you know, I mean, it's very similar to what happened here in the United States with the indigenous communities, right? They were forced to settle or coerced to settle in communities through various means. Up actually in Baffin Island, some of the Canadian soldiers actually killed the family's dogs, and that was their primary means of transportation. So there's a pretty dark history up there. And when this happened, there was a big movement to assimilate them into Western ways. And one of the things was parenting, right? And so many of the elders up there told me, you know, that colonialism has damaged the traditional parenting approaches. And so there is this really big concerted movement in Iqaluit to bring it back. So there's classes, parenting classes and daycare instructor classes. And there's also preschools where they speak, you know, the native language, and there's college courses. And we also went to another town called Kugarak, which is a small town. And there the families have really preserved a lot of the traditional parenting approaches, and they really value it.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Michaeline Duclef about her book, Hunt, Gather, Parent, What Ancient Cultures Can Teach Us About the Lost Art of Raising Happy, Helpful Little Humans. And so this way of raising kids, you call the TEAM, or the team way. And before we define it, you actually say the kids are hardwired to be raised in the way that you discovered here. What do you mean by that?
I think that if you look at a kind of a combination of psychology and evolutionary biology, you can kind of see evidence that children have evolved, human children have evolved over hundreds of thousands of years, to relate to their parents, to relate to adults and caretakers in a certain way. And this comes from a mixture of looking at modern day hunter-gatherer communities. You know, humans spent 200, 300,000 years as hunter-gatherers, but also looking at babies and how babies act and kind of their innate instincts. And so, for instance, very young children, you know, 18 months, even younger, are incredibly helpful. They will be more helpful than you and I in some situations. So for instance, if somebody drops something, a stranger even drops something, they will pick it up for the stranger, or they will move a chair out of the way so that a person can walk by. So they're hardwired to be helpful. And I think that there's a way of relating to children as a parent that encourages and promotes and nurtures this instinct. And there's a way of relating to children that kind of extinguishes it and erodes it. And I think a lot of things that we do in Western culture are the latter, unfortunately. But this approach that I talk about in the book is meant to nurture this in children, their helpfulness, their desire to help. And it's also a way of of recognizing the helpfulness in children, because I think we've kind of lost the ability to see when a child wants to be helpful, because it's not exactly the same as an adult.
What do you mean by that?
So, for instance, there's some really interesting research actually with my communities in the U.S., and researchers will ask parents there, as well as middle-class American parents, a child runs over to you while you're doing the laundry. It's, let's say, a two-year-old, and she starts throwing the clothes all over the room. You know, what do you think about that? How do you interpret that? And so many middle-class American parents, like myself, would say, oh, she's just making a huge mess. She just wants to play. You know, so I shoo her away and tell her to go play. You know, I got to get this laundry done. Whereas some of the indigenous parents in Mexico, including some Maya moms, actually say, well, you know, at first I'm a little angry because she's making a mess. But second of all, I'm excited because she's showing interest in wanting to help with the laundry. And so I guide her. I invite her in and I guide her and show her how to do it. So a parent could interpret the throwing the laundry around as a kid making a mess and not being helpful. Or a parent could interpret that as the kid actually wants to help and wants to be included in the task. They just don't know how. And so a lot of the book in Hunt Gather Parent is me kind of learning this other approach and learning to see that when I do interpret Rosie, my little girl's actions as helpful, and I guide her and teach her, then this wonderful thing happens where she becomes helpful, like actually helpful. And we start getting along a lot better, because when I push her away, I'm going against that innate instinct to help. And it's a very pro-social instinct, right? The instinct to work as a team and be together and contribute.
Yeah. And, you know, I think what you point out there is that so often we overestimate children's emotional intelligence, so that we're constantly in this book. I mean, it was so clear that we are constantly misinterpreting what our kids' instincts or motivations are. Talk a little bit more about that and how this approach that you're talking about helps to develop that, you know, what we call executive function, the ability to take perspective, to anticipate consequences, to organize, to plan.
Yeah, this is such a great question. And it comes a lot from those parents up in Iqaluit and Cougar Rock in Nunavut, Canada. So we definitely overestimate children's emotional ability. You know, we expect little two-year-olds to be able to control their anger and not get upset, you know, or very quickly calm themselves down, when a lot of adults can't do that. It's a very hard thing to do for some people. So when I went up to Canada the first time, I really wanted to learn how to get Rosie to stop hitting me. I was asking all these moms, and I said to one mom, I said, well, you know, I think she's, you know, pushing my buttons, or she's manipulating me. And this mom, I will never forget, her name's Lisa Ipoli. She's an interpreter and a journalist. But she said to me, she just laughed at me. She literally laughed. She was like, she's not manipulating you and pushing your buttons. She's too, like, she doesn't understand that, you know, she is just this irrational, illogical being. And this is how a lot of cultures view children, young children. They're just these irrational, emotionally wild creatures, right? That don't have emotional regulation, don't have executive function like you're talking about. And so your job, and she even said, your job as a parent is to show her this, is to show her how to control her emotions. And if you get upset at her, number one, it doesn't make much sense to get angry at an irrational being. It's not going to help. You can't argue your way out of, you know, when someone's illogical or irrational, it doesn't help to argue with them. So if you get upset, number one, you are just basically stooping to the level of the child. You're being immature. You're having your own tantrum. But number two, you're not showing the child how you're supposed to behave. And so what I learned is that a lot of parents it's not that they're suppressing their anger or their frustration at a child. They actually have less of it. They have less anger, less frustration at children, because they view the child not as this like irrational, illogical being. They don't see the child's motivations as nefarious or personal, right? So Rosie slapping me in the face is not a personal thing. It's just, she doesn't understand. She doesn't have the emotional abilities yet. And my job is to show her, okay, when somebody gets upset at you and is, you know, physical with you or whatever, how are you supposed to behave? And what that looks like is an incredibly calm, you know, kind of very unemotional response. And it was incredible. I have to tell you, once I started reacting to Rosie's tantrum and emotional outbursts with like incredible calmness, incredible, like very little emotion, very little words, Rosie found that response in herself. And very quickly, like after a couple of weeks, the tantrums just went from like one or two a day to like one or two a month. It was really incredible.
That's amazing. And another thing, you mentioned this before about praise. You know, we live in a culture which is always talking about, you know, self-esteem. And, you know, you have to, in schools, it's like it's just nonstop, the self-esteem mantra. What's the problem with praise?
So, you know, that whole self-esteem idea that like it's the parent's job to maintain and raise up a child's self-esteem. And if you don't, there's going to be all these problems. That comes from like the 70s and 80s, very, very shaky, non-existent science. It's a very interesting history. It is not scientifically backed by any stretch of the imagination. And yet we think that we have to really do this, right? We really think children's self-esteem is kind of this like very fragile thing that we have to preserve. But there's no evidence for that at all. And in fact, if you look all around the world, children receive very little praise in many, many cultures. And yet they have incredible self-esteem, confidence, self-sufficiency. I mean, everything you want praise to do, these children have. And here's the thing about praise. First of all, we don't really know what effect all this praise has. One of the psychologists told me, you know, we're kind of doing this big experiment on kids because for the first time in human history, they're just getting drenched in praise. So we think that praise, you know, like you say, builds up self-esteem. We think it can motivate children. But the problem is it's not always that way. It's a tricky beast. If you praise, overpraise, praise in situations where the child doesn't feel like they have deserved it, it can actually demotivate children. In some studies, there's hints of it increased anxiety. One psychologist told me that she thinks American kids are addicted to praise, that like they're doing things just for praise. And then the last thing, which I definitely see, I only have one kid, but I see it with my daughter, with other kids, is that praise can trigger conflict in competition, especially between siblings, because they're competing with each other for praise. So I think at the end of the day, we think praise is like all good. You can't do too much and you have to do it. And if you look throughout history and around the world, it's actually the other way around. I think you really don't need to praise children very much at all. You know, like maybe a nod of the head. And there's other ways, much better ways of motivating children and giving them that confidence and self-esteem that you're looking for with praise.
And so how do you motivate children, not just without praise, but without rewards or threats?
Yeah. And this is so key. And it's really a hard thing to understand. I think I just say you have to read chapter 6 of the book. But it's this idea of accepting their contributions and making them part of your life and your work. So for instance, that little kid that runs over and once it starts throwing the laundry around the room, that child really does want to be part of your world and help with that laundry. If you look at biology, psychology, and you look at evolutionary biology, children are born helpful and they want to help. And so if you accept that help, you know, okay, you want to help with the clothes? Let's throw them into the laundry bin, or I'll show you how to fold them. Let's fold them together, right? So you accept the child's invitation to help. That is way more motivating to a child than praise. You're giving the child right there the three ingredients that psychologists say cause intrinsic motivation, just motivation that you do on your own. You're connecting with the child. You're giving them a sense of choice or autonomy because they've come over and they've shown that they want to help. And the last thing is letting them be competent. You're saying, okay, you want to help? Here, come help. Let me give you something that you can actually do. So another example is like if you're cooking, right? And your kid comes over and starts to chop up the vegetable. Okay, here, come over. Yeah, come help me. Yes, here, chop these vegetables. You could take even if the vegetables are horribly chopped, you could take the vegetables and throw them out and not use them because they're not good. Or you could kind of trim them a little bit and then use them. And that acceptance of that contribution is way more motivating to that child than you saying, oh, great job with the vegetables. They look amazing.
That's great. You know, what about with older kids, with teens, or even with other grown-ups?
Yeah, it's such a great question. And it's something I want to write about because I get asked it a lot. So I will say when I first started trying these ideas, especially with the helpfulness and training. So a big part of the book is training a child to be helpful and cooperative. I realized like that I'm never going to be able to do that until I start cooperating with my partner, which I have to say, we've been married 21 years. And I was like watching him and I was like, this is not cooperation going on here. And so I started like using the same methods, like on both the kid and the husband kind of at the same time and on myself, because I wasn't cooperating with him as well. There's no doubt. We were both at fault, but I was kind of amazed at how well they worked with us. Like we cooperate now and have so much less conflict when it comes to chores around the house that I want to write about it because it absolutely works. You know, it's, you know, with the little kids, it's all about welcoming them and like, okay, they want it. They really want to help. And so you want to like, just keep encouraging that. I think with older kids and adults, it's about getting them back motivated. So very kind of gentle things. So for instance, my husband will be like hanging out with me after, you know, while we're making dinner and, you know, to get him involved, I'll just be like, oh, can you grab this from the refrigerator or, hey, chop this garlic. So I give him like these very small tasks. And they're very easy. And the point of that is a couple fold. First of all, if they're easy enough, any kid's going to do it. Anybody's going to do it, right? There's going to be a lot less resistance than if you give a complex task. But second of all, you're teaching them to work together with you and work together as a team. And that is so much everybody from a baby to a 7-year or 5-year-old. If you work together as a team, people are going to be much more likely to do it and want to do it than if you each have your kind of separate tasks that you're working on independently.
Yes. But of course, when it comes to things like homework, it can be a lot.
Yeah. You know, it's very interesting because there's a paper on helpfulness that I cite a lot in the book. We're looking at kids that take initiative and help on their own. So like Maria's daughter who did the dishes. And in that same paper, I missed it the first couple times I read it. It talks about how kids that take initiative with chores around the house also tend to take initiative with their homework, which is really interesting, right? So it's this idea that when you teach the child to do things voluntarily, to do chores voluntarily and to help voluntarily, you're teaching them to take initiative and have initiative. And that ripples over into their homework as well. And so sometimes as American parents, we think the more we manage and control and kind of schedule things out for kids, the more likely they're going to do it. But modern psychology actually tells you that could really backfire in that giving the kid the space to volunteer to do the dishes, to volunteer to help with the dinner, will actually give them this empowerment to make their own schedule in terms of like their homework and the other things that they need to do.
Hmm. And so let's end with Rosie. What's she like now?
Oh my gosh. I love Rosie so much now. I mean, I have to say, like I said in the book, like she is one of my favorite people. She really is. And the reason is because she's one of the few people in my life that I cooperate with, that I really know how to work together with as a team, you know, and we still argue sometimes. Last night we were arguing over something, but you know, it's much quicker and we move on much quicker. And I think we both really feel like we want to help each other and we enjoy working together as a team. And I think this book, while writing it, really taught me to see her contributions to our family and to see her desire to help and to listen to her. At the end of the day, I was not listening to her. I thought I knew the answers to everything that we were doing. And in fact, she has really great ideas and she has really great contributions to our family. And I love being able to connect with her in this way that I couldn't before writing this book.
Well, and that is such a gift, really. And your book, too, has just so many great ideas. It's wonderful. Hunt, Gather, Parent. And it's just been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Michaeline Duclef. You can hear an audio excerpt from Hunt, Gather, Parent by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, empathy, digital technology, and the fascinating story of Sherry Turkle. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. They're free. MIT social psychologist Sherry Turkle is best known for her books, Reclaiming Conversation and Alone Together. They offer penetrating insights into the toll that digital technology has taken on our human connections. Now, in her intimate memoir of love and work, The Empathy Diaries, Turkle ties together her own life story and her path-breaking research on technology, empathy, and ethics. Growing up in post-war Brooklyn, Turkle searched for clues to her identity in a house filled with mysteries. Empathy became her strategy of survival as she strove to master the codes that governed her family's secrets. In The Empathy Diaries, Turkle asks the big question that has motivated her research lifelong. How does one change minds? She discovers the clue to unlock that process of change through examining her own story of growing up. It's all about creating and preserving connections between people. Sherry Turkle is professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology in the program in Science, Technology, and Society at MIT, and she's the founding director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self. Sherry Turkle, welcome to Writer's Voice.
I'm so happy to be here.
The Empathy Diaries is such a beautifully constructed memoir. You weave your personal story, especially of your early family life, into the story of the questions that you've been dealing with in your work as a social psychologist, if I can use that term. In fact, your personal life laid the foundation for those questions. Tell us about the connection between the two.
Well, the way I see it is that I was born into a family that wanted me to keep a secret. And the secret was me. I was the product of my mother's first marriage. She wanted to keep the marriage a secret. So that was inconvenient since I was the child of that marriage and I carried my father's name. And most of all, she wanted to keep him a secret. There was something about him that she didn't want anybody to know. I never knew what it was, but she didn't want me to have his name. She went back to being a Bonowitz, which was her maiden name. But there I was, Sherry Zimmerman, and there was just nothing to do about it except hide the fact. Hide him from me. Somehow there I was, a part of the Bonowitz clan, never to talk about him. We never discussed him. So all of this to say, to get back to your question, is that I couldn't make heads or tails of this. And in order to, not to put too fine a point on it, not go crazy, I had to figure out what there was that was motivating the people in my life to behave this way. These were loving adults who wanted the best for me. What could they have been thinking? And so I sort of became the Nancy Drew of my own life story, trying to pick up clues about my identity. Who was my father? Why was he being hidden? And most of all, to become empathic with my mother, my grandmother, my grandfather, my aunt, my mother's sister, who were raising me in a tissue of lies. How did these loving people, what was on their mind? What were their motivations since they would not talk to me?
You had a kind of aid in your early childhood. in your investigations as the Nancy Drew of your life, and that was something you call the memory cabinet. And I really saw in that a link between your history, your personal history, and, you know, the questions that have entranced you and involved you for most of your life. Talk about that.
Yes. Well, you know, what were the materials at my disposal? I could try to talk to my family, but conversation was closed down. It was a taboo to talk about my father. So I began a sort of process of investigation of the material culture of the one-bedroom apartment that we lived in Brooklyn. You know, was there any trace of my history in this apartment? And all of the books and papers and the autograph books from my aunt and my mother's, you know, elementary school and high school and college, you know, pictures of old boyfriends, all of these were stored in a cupboard above the kitchen table with old books and bullets from World War I that my uncles had brought home. Anyway, every night after dinner, I was allowed to push the kitchen table towards that closet and investigate that closet, which I did methodically, opening up every page to see if there was an inscription, to see if there was a picture, looking behind every picture. And finally, I found, when I was 3 years old, a book that was inscribed to Sherry Zimmerman. And it was the first time that I saw my name in my life and realized that my name was Sherry Zimmerman. I'd never seen it, but I knew it was mine. And I also found, finally, a picture of a man with his face rubbed out. And I knew, again, without being told, that that was my father. So I found two clues to my identity in this memory closet. And maybe the child sociologist ethnographer was born at that moment. But those were the two clues to my identity that I found as a child.
You know, what's so interesting is a lot throughout this book, The Empathy Diaries, Sherry Turkle, you talk about this knowing and not knowing.
Yes.
And I just wonder if you could talk more about that, and how does that drive somebody to investigate things in a way that so many other people don't even think to think about?
Well, it's so interesting that you raise that. When you write a memoir, it's such a different process than talking to someone casually about your life, because the burden is on you. Unless you're a movie star, you know, and people just want to know, like, who was your third grade teacher? Because you're a movie star, you know. You have to engage the reader in some thematic material where they'll say, oh my God, that was my life too. And I thought that this question of the things we know, but we can't admit we know, was really one of the major themes of my life. That's a major theme of so many people's lives. And my best example was the fact that all my life, practically from the time I was 8 years old, my mother knew she was dying and didn't want to tell me. Because she wanted me to live my life. My dream was to go away to college. I knew I wanted to go away to Radcliffe, like from when I was a baby. John F. Kennedy went to Harvard. I wanted to go to Harvard. You couldn't go to Harvard because you were a girl. I wanted to go to Radcliffe. She wanted me to have all of my dreams. And she felt that if I knew she was dying, she had metastatic breast cancer, and it took her, she fought it and fought it. And in those days, fighting it was hard, and it took her nine, she fought it for 9 years. I wouldn't do that. I would stay home. I would go to Brooklyn College. I would stay very close to her. And yet, while officially I didn't know she was dying, there were so many clues. There were so many ways in which I did know she was dying. And I think that theme of there being so many things in my life, for example, my father's identity, theoretically, I knew nothing about him. But when I finally met him, I felt I knew all this. I don't want to give away everything about the book. I want people to read the book, but it is the reason I don't want to give away, it's kind of a mystery story of who he was. And when the reader meets who he is, they realize, oh my God, she married a guy who's just like him. You know, how did she know that? You know, she's structured her life to put herself in an environment filled with people like that. How did she know that if she didn't already know who he was? And actually, when I find out very dramatically that my mother is dying, really, I find out from a doctor who finally says to me, don't you know that? I mean, I'm in the hospital, and he tells me, I realize that I've known. I've known but not known. And I think that that has been so much a part of my life, that knowing and not knowing so many things since I was a child, that that brought me to a career in which I'm constantly asking myself, I have a hunch, I think I know, can I nail this down with research?
And you also have sought to bring together different disciplines in really innovative ways. You studied psychoanalysis. You have studied the whole role of computers. I want to get more into that and more in detail later. But I want to come back to this theme of empathy, because you have informed your work on computers with what you know through your life about empathy. And I wonder if you could just draw out that connection more strongly. I mean, you entitled your memoir, The Empathy Diaries.
Well, my greatest fear about computers is that without wanting to, it isn't as though that in the early days of computer culture, people said, oh, I know what computers are good for. They're good for sapping the empathy out of a human race. I mean, that's like, it wasn't like the design. But as I got deeper and deeper into the study of the computer culture, I could say to myself, hold on, this is an empathy underminer. And from very, very early. And I'll give you a good example from the early days of artificial intelligence, something that is in the Empathy Diaries. I go to see a movie about artificial intelligence with Marvin Minsky, who's like the big AI guru. And it's a movie called Tron. And it's about how in the future with artificial intelligence, there'll be programs that live within, you know, within a program, and that'll be the artificial intelligence. And he's so excited. We go there with a horde of MIT students, and they're fussing about him. And he's after the movie, he's making speeches. They're all excited. And he says to me, I'm a young MIT faculty member. And he says to me, I loved this movie. This is exactly how MIT, how AI is going to be. And children should see this movie. They shouldn't see Bambi. You know, Walt Disney's Bambi. And I take the bait. I say, I love Bambi. You know, I'm thinking ahead to the children I'm going to have. You know, I said, everybody loves Bambi. Bambi, why not Bambi? I mean, I take his bait. And he says, because Bambi teaches that human attachment is important. And when there are the robots that can take care of the people, and when we become part AI and part human, children shouldn't learn that human attachments are that important.
I mean, it's really actually tragic when you think about it.
And I say to him, Marvin, you're kidding me, because I'm so gullible. Because if you're not kidding me, I'm going to write about this. So take it back. You know me. I'm writing a book about this. Take it back. And I'm not going to, you know, quote you. He says, no, we are going to become half robotic, half people. Our main attachments are going to be with robots. And you don't want to teach children that empathy. And I put it in the book. It's part of that zeitgeist. And as I became more and more part of a world where that was the zeitgeist, I felt more and more comfortable saying, no, that's a world where empathy is not important. And to me, the essential human value, the thing that we offer each other, is empathy. So no.
And I don't think an accident that it took a woman to look at that and to say those things. You know, I was really struck. Let's go back a little bit. I was really struck about how you did go to Radcliffe, and then your mother died, and for a time you ended up in Paris, very much with the encouragement of your wonderful Aunt Mildred. you know, and there really is the sense that, you were really put first in your family in a way that is just, you know, it's a model. I mean, not that everyone was perfect, but they really did do their best, and you were so loved. So, but you end up in Paris in 1968, one of the great turning points, I think, in modern history. And, you know, one of the things that has been so important, the big question that's been so important to you, is how do people change their minds? And this was the place where you first began to ask that question. And that question is very much at the heart of what we've just been talking about in some way. That is, you know, what did they change their minds about?
Well, I think that, you know, people say, well, why do you spend so much time on this? That's such a wonderful question, Francesca, because people keep saying, why do you dwell on the Paris years? I mean, it doesn't have to do with computers. It really doesn't have to do with empathy. I mean, and you've hit the nub of why I dwell on those years, because I had to be brought to my essential research question, which is, how do people change their minds? That became my research question for the rest of my academic life. And I realized that research question was a research question that came deeply from my personal life. How do people connect with each other? How do people change their minds about their own psychology? Can you get someone to change their mind? To what degree about something deep and psychological? And the French had lived in this highly structured way. There was a way you treated your priest. There was a way you treated your teacher. There was a way you talked to your aunt and your second aunt and your mother's second sister and your mother. And I mean, everything was so determined. You know, it wasn't just that there was an order to how you ate dinner. There was an order, and an order to how you ate lunch, and an order to how what you had for breakfast. There was an order to how you greeted everyone, and how you went through school. And if you didn't place a certain way, you know, when you were 5 years old, well, it was sort of finished for you. I mean, and May 68, although people say, well, it didn't succeed politically. I mean, Charles, it was a big uprising of workers and students, and they made a strike, but then it was kind of over when de Gaulle said in June, well, you know, that's enough. We're going back to work. We're going back to school. But, you know, it wasn't over. It wasn't over in terms of the way French people dressed and addressed themselves and related to religion and related to school. And it didn't really ever go back to the way it was.
I remember the great slogan of May 1968, which is "All power to the imagination."
Yes, yes. And also they said, this is not your father's revolution, meaning don't look for the results of this revolution and whether or not we have a change in government. That's not what we're necessarily have our eyes on. Look to whether we have sex before marriage. Look to whether we marry interracially. Look to whether we marry across class lines. Look to whether we take jobs in the arts if our dad tells us to go to medical school. I mean, all kinds of things that younger people wanted to do that they hadn't maybe done.
And you can almost see, I see a connection between what we've just been talking about in terms of computers, because in a way you're describing a very structured and engineered society.
Yes.
And you can almost see, I see a connection between what we've just been talking about in terms of computers, because in a way you're describing a very structured and engineered society.
Absolutely. And I came back to that after my time in Paris. I came back to this much more open society in America. And I recognized it. When I dropped out of Harvard, when I dropped out of Radcliffe to go to Paris after my mother died, women couldn't use the Harvard library system. I mean, literally, as a Radcliffe freshman and junior, I read in the basement of a church, and there wasn't a place to take out books in Harvard Yard. All of that was changing by the time I came back. There weren't female tenured faculty at Harvard. I didn't know whether, as a woman, I could make a day job out of being an academic. So all of this was changing. All of those things that had seemed natural were changing. So my life experience was giving me models for that people can change their thinking, but what has to happen to change their thinking? And I came upon these ideas, two ideas, that were operant then and that I think are operant now as we come out of the pandemic. So I see the Empathy Diaries as very much a book that is guiding my ideas about what positive we can take out of this moment of disruption. Because so many of the things that were operant then as people got ready for massive social change and changes in thought are operant now. And those two ideas are that the period is liminal. That is to say, it's a time betwixt and between a moment of rules and a moment where you don't know what the rules are going to be. You know, are we going really to go back to rules and Jim Crow rules all over the country for voting? Are we really going to go back to that? Or are we going to say, no, those can't be the rules in the future. We're going to really shake things up so that those aren't the rules in the future. But we don't know. So we're at a point where, you know, you can feel the country saying, okay, are we going to have a massive movement of large companies to make sure that voting rights are a thing in this country? We've never had that. That is very new. And are we going to push them? What is that really going to look like? That didn't happen in the 60s. They were not on board in that way for the anti-Vietnam protests. So you get that sense of shakeup of the rules not being clear, and amazing things can happen that can change what comes next. And then the second thing is that during the pandemic, Americans have been able to see their country as though from the outside. And that experience of being able to see your country, we've watched our country on television, and that has given us a new view.
My sense was people both, they were stopped from their normal life, so the normal way couldn't go on. They were watching things on television, and the only people that they were depending on, that they could see depending on for their lives, were Black and brown people who were still working because they had to work. And I think that all those things had something to do with the solidarity that emerged around George Floyd's death and the Black Lives Matter movement. But my question is this, because people talk a lot about how we're in different ideologies, you know, the ideologies are so, there's a left on the one hand and the right on the other, you know, as if left and right are somehow, you know, equal to each other and we all have to come back to the middle. But in fact, it seems to me what's happening is that people are working to prioritize human connection and human relationships, something that is such a great theme of yours, versus an ideology that is really trying to cut off any sense of responsibility to other human beings, which is the right wing gone to the extreme. And that we no longer really have, a partner to talk to on the other side. The gap is great. And it's not just about position. It's about relationship. And our relationship to relationship.
No, I think you have just articulated why this is different. Because no matter how much people want to say this is left and right and it's just the old left and right is the old left and right. No, it's not. When the right says we can't bring you water when you're voting, you can't eat food and water. You say, hold on, wait, stop. I want to see where, you know, in the voter security, left-right thing, keeping old people from dying of heat prestation or stroke, or want to see where that used to really be a problem. You know, no, that's just about human decency or relating to each other as people. I mean, there's this thing that, you know, you're going to not have the extremity and the dehumanization implied in these new restrictions. You know, really, I think what you're pointing to is that now we are talking about really going back to the country not seeing some of its members as human, which is something that we've, you know, I think that's been true for a while, but now people can see it in its raw form. And so I think that this decountrifying has allowed people to see what was always there, but we didn't want to see. And now we can see it, including income inequality, including Me Too, including, you know, the racism and the institutional racism. And I remember the day, I mean, and also the fragility that we live on. I remember the day that I was sitting, you know, watching television, and I didn't know what I was looking at. It was like an arena, and all these beautiful cars were picking up food at a food bank, the first time they'd ever been to a food bank, all these Lexus station wagons, you know, picking up food for the first time at a food bank. And I said, you know, this is America, that people really are one paycheck away, two paychecks away from needing to go to a food bank.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I'd like to bring in your work on computers in here also, because it goes to the question on how do we change minds. You also pose the question in this book, in The Empathy Diaries, Sherry Turkle. You pose the question of, you know, how do we change our relationship with the computers that increasingly dominate our lives? I mean, you say, it was great, we're not users, but we're the killer app of computers. I mean, I thought that was brilliant. And, you know, you set it up with how engineers have constructed our world, but it's not just about engineers. There's also about power. And how do we share power, and how do we limit power, and how do we control power? To me, that's very much at the heart of what we've just been talking about. But also then, how do we move forward? I mean, we ain't going to go back to the Luddite version of no computers unless we have, you know, a major hacking event or a solar flare. We need to change our relationship. How do we humanize that relationship? How do we bring responsibility to human beings back to the center?
Well, this again is where I think the pandemic has helped us in a certain sense, because I've been starting to study this. And I was studying parents' attitudes towards, you know, bringing a lot more computer power into education pre-pandemic. And a lot of people were starting to be very excited by an idea that was floated by the computer industry of, you know, a computer environment for your kid that would, you know, measure every keystroke and specialize in creating an AI model of your child's learning and, you know, create a curriculum just for him or her and, you know, be a tutor and a kind of coach. You know, you can see where this is going, and bring him or her the most exciting lectures. I mean, you know, other famous people could be teaching from all over the world, and kind of cradle to college grave, as you know, this child. And I think parents, after this year, of course, there'd be no privacy, and of course, the child would be sold, all kinds of stuff along the way. And I think parents now, when the industry tries to sell them all this personalized coaching, are very likely to say, could my child please have a person? My child needs a person to talk to, a mentor, somebody who can show an interest, somebody who can show some love, somebody who can show some caring, some warmth, empathy. My child needs to be given that moment that in the Empathy Diaries I show I was given over and over and over again of somebody saying, look, Sherry, that's a bad essay, but come again. Let's do this together again. Those are, I say in the Empathy Diaries, the magic words for mentorship that will make even as rough a creature as I was when I started out, that will make them blossom. That will make them blossom together again, again, together from a human being who is listening. And I think that parents, after having gone through this year, are much more able to say, I'm ready to do that.
And they also have a much deeper understanding of what it means to be a teacher.
Exactly, and appreciation. And maybe we'll give them some more respect. I mean, this whole thing about treating people as calling people essential workers, and really what we mean by that is that we want them to serve us, but we don't want them. We don't want to give them the minimum wage, and we don't want to give them health care or vaccines or they're essential. They're essential to serve me. I mean, it really is a slippage of language that we'll be analyzing for scholars. We'll be analyzing, my students at least, will be analyzing for decades to come. You know, essential to whom and for what? I think essential to pay and essential to take care of and essential to nurture is what essential should mean. And we've taken it as essential to abuse.
Absolutely.
I don't think I responded completely. I said, so the first thing is that we will be more empowered. But the second thing is we will be more savvy about how our information is being scraped. And we will maybe be ready to say to the industry, you know, there really is a way to organize your business so that you don't scrape our information. So maybe we'd like to pay you a little bit for some of the services you give. And could you change your business model? I'd rather pay than just have you scrape my information. That is a change in their business model, but consumers can demand that. And I think, you know, we've just assumed that they form their business model and we just have to either take it or leave it. But that is not a given. And I think that there's going to be movement in that area. I believe there's a golden triangle of democracy, privacy, and intimacy. You can't have intimacy without privacy. You can't have democracy without privacy. The intimacy, privacy, democracy triangle is something that I've been trying to pitch for 25 years, and it has been a very hard sell. I have not had a ton of allies. I've made a lot of enemies. I don't want to say that my career has been filled with fighting off enemies, but it has not been an easy sell. And I think that sell is getting easier now.
Could you say a little bit more about that and what that means? That sounds, especially that intimacy part, because intimacy and empathy are intimately related.
Yeah. In other words, when my grandmother, who was not an immigrant but had immigrant parents and grew up with stories of the old country, grew up with stories of the Holocaust, I mean, a very big part of my book is about how the shadow of the Holocaust fell over my childhood and was very much a part of my upbringing and the creation of my sensibility. It created a sensibility where literally I was brought up to feel that if ever I saw, and your listeners will understand, they'll be more empathic with my troubled state of mind now. I was brought up to believe that if ever I saw the slightest sign of fascism in the United States, my instructions were to leap into action like Wonder Woman and to fight it. And so here I was during the pandemic, and all I saw were signs of proto-fascism in the United States wherever I looked. I'm just saying that I was brought up to feel as though fighting fascism in America was my job. You know, I think that that now in the industry, it's such an important time to make this connection. My grandmother would take me, I digress, forgive me. My grandmother would take me to the mailboxes in Brooklyn, and she would point to the mailboxes and she would say, "This is America. The mail, nobody opens your mail in America. This is what democracy is." Now, of course, there was J. Edgar Hoover. There was, I'm not naive, and I'm not a Pollyanna, and America was, you know, it was like a very bad time for democracy in America. She knew about the McCarthy hearings. She was very savvy, but she was making a point. Max Weber would call it, you know, an ideal type, that according to the law in America, we were protected, that you could use the mail and the government wouldn't open your mail. And in the old country, that wasn't true. And she wanted me to become an American citizen who held the country to the law. And I feel that social media, the practices of the large tech companies, have been given a free pass. The deal is they read your mail. We've said it's okay that they read our mail. I mean, what are we thinking that we gave that up, assuming that that wouldn't change our way of thinking about privacy? And if you read my you know, I want people to buy the empathy diaries, but if you read my other books, there are, well, I think I actually, I pick up this woman who I interviewed in the empathy diaries who says, I don't care if Facebook reads my mail, who would care about me and my little wife? And it turns out everybody, because they're making money off you. And we've got to get out of this way of thinking. Your little life is very important. And not just because somebody's making money off you, but because people's attitude towards their privacy changes. And people's attitude towards their political possibilities change if they feel that they're being watched.
Sherry Turkle talking about her new memoir, The Empathy Diaries. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Carrie Gillum about the Monsanto Papers, her spellbinding account of how one middle school groundskeeper took on one of the biggest polluters on the planet and won. We also talk with John Englander about the growing peril sea level rise poses to our communities and what to do about it. His book is Moving to Higher Ground. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.